You're listening to the Artist First World Radio Network, artistfirst.com. Tony K in the studio. Thanks, audience, for joining us worldwide. All broadcasts available free on demand. Simply visit artistfirst.com for updates. And those who are contributing to the arts, thank you for your generous participation at artistfirst.com. All broadcasts available free on demand 24/7. Be sure to share our content with everyone you know on your social network sites. This hour on Authors First, it's my privilege to introduce a contributor to the arts in so many ways. Sean Seary is joining us, author, playwright, multilingual musician, romantic author. He's written several novels, theater plays, magazine articles, self-help books, and of course, scripts for television. Sean Seary served as the chief judge at the 2017 International Peace and Film Festival. You may have seen him there. And of course, he is a proud single parent who revels in his adventurous children. Let's give a warm welcome to our guest, to Authors First this hour, Sean Seary. How do you do, Sean?
Well, thank you very much. It sounds so much more impressive when you say it than when I do, but I appreciate it.
Well, that's the idea, Sean, I'll tell you. But no, really, you are incredible. Thank you for spending this quality time with us at Artist First Radio and giving back once again in such a positive way as we reach out to the world of literature, those who have creative aspirations in the arts. And, you know, it takes a vision and a dedication to the arts. We often call them the starving arts because it requires such a high level of skill to really make it. And even then, you could have a lot of skill and no one knows you exist, you know. Mm-hmm. And I've seen some fabulous artists that are unknown, really. And Artist First Radio, artistfirst.com, is a platform for people just like that who have tremendous gifts and talent, but perhaps just not that well known. And Sean, thank you for all that you've been doing in a lifetime of writing so skillfully and being an inspiration to so many others. Your critique as judge in a festival is phenomenal, and thank you for that gift of leadership and example there. And for bringing it all together, I tell you, it's not often that we at Artist First Radio are privileged to have someone that touches base with multiple areas of the arts. Sean, how did it begin for you? I know you had a very dramatic childhood, traveling, and you're bilingual, which means those experiences opened up the opportunity for you to become skilled in other languages.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. My dad was, he was in the military, and even though he was a traditional farmer, back in the day, he was drafted, and so he had to join the military, and of course the family had to tag along to all these wonderful assignments, which was actually a blessing, you know, because otherwise you just see life from a farm in Tennessee any other way. So we got to move with him, and the first place we stopped, of course, was jolly old England. And that's where I picked up my accent, because my parents are, of course, American, and so am I. But I learned to walk and talk and everything there in England, and kind of carried over this bizarre accent that occasionally slips to American and back to British. But it's just one of those things you pick up. But the languages, of course, aside from English, I learned just out of necessity for, in some cases, dating girls, you know, who were from another country. I want to, you know, well, I mean, I am a romance author after all, so let's just be honest about it. But great motivation to learn a foreign language, and that's probably why I speak the number of them that I do, because I'm very attracted to foreign accents. I just find it so much more intriguing when someone speaks another language, you know.
Yes, and let's be also honest, Sean, they are the romance languages,
Absolutely. Yeah. For good reason.
Yes. And a lover of history as well. I think having gone through 10 schools before you graduate from high school on multiple continents really gives you an international flair and worldview growing up.
Oh, indeed. And you know what was, I mean, when I look back at that, again, another gift that you, at the time, you're sort of frustrated because you're constantly making new friends and saying goodbye to the ones you just kind of got attached to. What was interesting for me personally, and others who maybe have gone through this could say the same thing, is at one school, you know, I could have been the most popular, you know, guy in the whole school. Everybody knew me. I got along great with teachers, good grades. Next school, I was a complete nerd, outcast, couldn't make a friend to save my life. And it was just like this, you know, it's like I'm the same person. The only thing that's changed, other than, of course, the people, was the geography. And it made me realize that I had to know who I was, regardless of where I lived. And also that, what if you grew up in a place where you were always the outcast, always the one that didn't get along with others, and you thought that's what life was like? I mean, how tragic, right? So I'm glad that we moved around. I'm glad I got to see a little bit more of the world, perhaps at a younger age than others might get to. And then I, of course, just continued traveling my whole life, really. But that was a great experience as a young person. One, you learn to make friends quickly. You know, you get over the initial shocks or fears or shyness that you might have walking into a room of people you don't know, especially when all of them already know each other. But that really helped me a lot, I think, with sort of defining, knowing inside who I really was, regardless of where I might be or who I might be with.
Well, the yin and the yang, you know, here we are, the good and the bad, wondering how a person is shaped in a direction of life selected. You're right, audience, I neglected to mention, Sean Seery is the author of The Beekeeper's Daughter.
Thank you.
And the website, KingdomOfMeridian.com, linked at artistfirst.com. Thank you, audience, for the reminder. Sean, but this journey of life, having the ability to interact with different cultures and languages and those nuances really were formative for you.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think it in some ways the languages really teach you to organize your mind, because when you've got more than one word, you know, different languages, for one object, you know, you have to sort of think about it differently. When you're looking at a cup on a table, it's always a cup until you learn the other word for it. And now you have to rearrange, you know, in your mind how you recognize that. And as more languages come in, I think it becomes more efficient. It's easier, you know, once you've learned a couple languages, you can pick up others quickly because you've already figured out that math in your head. But, yeah, it absolutely forms not just in terms of thinking, but in terms of problem solving or in being creative, you know, because you've got multiple cultures influencing your thoughts at that point.
Yes, we all have the vision now, Sean, the view, 15, hair, shoulder length with your guitar across, romancing the ladies in some language or combination thereof.
Well, yes, I'm guilty as charged, I suppose, on that, especially the lengthy hair. I don't know if I was very good at 15. That is when I started playing guitar, but at least I was trying. You know, everybody wants to be a rock and roll star, you know, when they're a teenager, or at least I did. And at that point, yes, of course, had an interest in girls that just never seemed to stop.
That's right. But going with that interest in music, you have a poetic sensibility, an understanding of emotion and depth of feeling. And early on, you migrated toward those arts.
Oh, yes. There was different ways that I think that sort of manifested itself. You know, learning guitar was just because I wanted to play and I loved music and always wanted to, oh, how does that song go? And I wish I could play it, you know, or be the guy on TV who's, you know, getting all the girls, whatever it was. It was just music was seemed to be this path.
Oh, yeah, yeah, Dire Straits.
Exciting. Right. You know, it was, money for nothing and all that. But in the 80s, especially because that was the time that I was becoming a young man, and I remember just, you know, we had never really seen music before. It was always just something that pumped out of your radio, and now it was on TV, and you could see who was singing, and it just glamorized it, I think, in such a way that it just made it 10 times more fascinating, you know, for me and everyone else.
We had Bowie. Yeah. Let's Dance. MTV in the 80s changed. It brought together music and visual arts in a way that hadn't been possible before.
Oh, right. And of course, this is a time when MTV actually played music videos. Now I think they're mostly just, I don't know, reality shows or something. I don't even watch it anymore, unfortunately. But back then, of course, it was just your favorite songs, you know, 24 hours a day. And just a great time, I think, to be young and have something new that sort of you felt belonged to you or your generation, as it were.
Well, you had to make a living somehow, or did you manage to find a university you could stay with?
Well, definitely we had to go to school. I think it was just one of those things that I didn't see a future without, the paper, as it were. I felt it was quite essential to get my degree, and it took a while, but I did graduate from the University of New York with a dual degree in psychology and sociology, which I think my dad to this day thought it really wasn't worth much because who's going to pay you for that? But it really did come in handy as far as being able to understand people, not just from personal experience, but, you know, the abnormal psychology, the regular psychology, management psychology, all these different things, they kind of play into how you interact with workers. And, of course, as I moved up, you know, in life to supervisory positions or management, that was the most valuable thing that I had was, you know, I had an understanding of psychology so I could approach people differently than just being the angry boss yelling at them and telling them to, you know, get it right or do something proper. So that was really it. I think that really helped a lot on that side, yes.
Absolutely. The interaction at university with individuals that are studying lots of fields, you know, and you really don't know what you're going to do with your life. You know, you could study to be an attorney and end up a social worker. You don't know. You know, it's really life often takes you in a direction other than what you train for in university, but you need that foundation.
Oh, yeah. And I think it was Steve Jobs who said, you know, when he looked at his life going forward, nothing was making sense in terms of the events, you know, the things that happened to him or the choices that he made. But looking backwards, it all lined up so perfectly. It made absolute sense to him why this had happened the way it did. And the class he took on fonts when he was in school that seemed useless, became this huge influence on how the computer was formed in the future. And you can easily see that looking backward, I think, but not forward. So that's a bit of the faith I think you have to just take when you're in that one class that you think, I'll never use this. Why do I have to take this midterm? You know, but that's how it goes.
Now, all along, of course, you're writing papers, school, so forth. When did your interest in novels and writing for articles, magazines, so forth, when did that begin to materialize for you?
I think I was really just dabbling at a younger age. It started with a few screenplays theater plays that I wrote. I was with a group of folks who liked to get up and perform, and I enjoyed doing it a little bit. I don't think I was such a great actor, but I could write a script and come up with a concept that we could go with. And there was a lot of impromptu and things like that, but we wanted to have some kind of message. And sometimes they were religious in nature. Sometimes they were just more philosophical. But I wrote those, and I realized that I had a way of explaining it that others could understand, and that was I didn't realize that was something people needed. I thought anyone could just sit down and write their ideas, and it would make sense. But I had a good friend telling me, no, it's not so simple, but maybe for you, but it's not so simple. Sometimes you can write something, and no one gets it. So you have at least the ability, in their eyes, they said, they were very kind, but I had this ability to explain an idea in a way that could resonate, and that sort of, I guess, started me on that path of maybe there's other things I could write that might be, you know, relevant or interesting or entertaining.
Oh, absolutely. And seeing it played out must have been, you know, exciting, right? I mean, here it is. I had the idea. I built the character or the scene, the concept, and there they are. They're actually engaged in acting it all out in front of your very
eyes. That moment right before the applause where you're just wondering, you know, did they get it? did it make sense? Maybe they missed that whole part that I put in there subtly. And then, of course, when the audience just blows up at cheering and crying and whatever you've got, it's you're like, oh, thank God, you know, it worked. That's a wonderful feeling.
And that euphoric event, I think, it keeps people doing what they do. You know, I've met entertainers, writers, they just get such pleasure from it when one person can recognize what it's contributing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so that was your early experience, and that kept you going.
Absolutely, and I think it kept me exploring, you know, which is, I think it's really important for anyone. If you're any kind of an artist, whether it's a musician or writer or just, you know, a regular human being, we've all got some art in us, I think. But I think it kept me exploring, like, what else could I do or where could I take it, or maybe there's a whole other direction I could try and just see if I'm any good at it or what I could learn from it. And so that kept me exploring because I did get such a charge from, you know, putting something together like that.
You have children. You fell in love with children. You wrote children's books. Is that an ongoing series?
Yes. Yes, the children's books are new. It was, again, another one of those departures from what you're already doing. So I had actually written the romance novel and had it produced, and it was out and published. And then I got this just sort of idea that had been, you know, one of those things that sits in the back of your head and kind of cooks for a while. And I thought, you know, I think I'll do a kid's book, a completely safe, you know, benign kid's book, not one so, you know, adventurous as the romance novel. And I put it together. It's called The Bear and Bee, and it's got a lot of interactive pieces to it. So it wasn't just a book. It was based on, of course, my experiences as a father. And basically the way the story goes is my kids would not go to bed. It was just this nightly war where they would not go to sleep. And I was a single dad, you know, so it was just tough. You need your sleep, too, and you've got to get up early and get them to school. And they were young, so my kids were not bad kids, but they just were so mischievous that they would sneak out. And they had room on each side of a hallway. And I would sit like a guard between the rooms waiting for that door to open, if you can imagine. And I think hopefully there's a lot of parents out there nodding their heads right now going, I know what you mean, have to do the same thing. And so this got to be a bit boring every night. I was on guard duty for about a half hour until I was sure they were asleep and had caught them getting up, and they knew I'm out there, so don't go. And I picked up my guitar, and I just played really to pass the time. And I noticed that they went to sleep much quicker that way. And so it wasn't hard to adapt that idea. And sitting in a hallway with those great acoustics, you know, I could just play, and it would just knock them right out. And then they would ask for it for a while. They'd say, you know, hey, Dad, you're going to play guitar tonight. And so then every night, you know, at bedtime during the week, I was playing guitar, which was great practice for me. And, of course, it gave them their nightly concert. And all, of course, 80s metal tunes, but all the slow songs, of course, not the fast ones. So they were listening to Metallica and, you know, Poison and different songs like this. But they didn't know what they were. I wasn't singing along because my voice is not so great. But I would just play the songs, and they knew them. And who had thought, you know, Guitar Hero comes out, and they're like, hey, we know these songs. This was years later, of course, when they were bigger and teenagers. But that's how that got started. So in the book, sorry to go such a long way, but in the book, I put the music that I would play for them at night into the book, so you can actually play that right through the book. You can click a button, it goes to the site and plays an MP3, and then you can listen to that while you're reading the book to your child.
Beautiful moments. You're capturing a moment. You're thinking back contemplatively about that experience that, you know, disappears so quickly. They grow up, they
indeed,
move on.
Indeed, yeah. And you know, I have to say, even though they're grown now, it's just I do miss it, and there's times when I think I should just have another batch, because it was one of the best times of your life. You know, you don't know it because you're so frustrated with school schedules and homework and getting them to soccer or whatever they're into, and it runs you a bit, but you feel good about yourself when you're taking care of a young person, whether it's through charities or through your own children.
Yes. Now, the age group, when you set out to begin writing, what were you thinking? How young?
I really wanted a book that would sort of be for the newer moms and dads out there who weren't sure how to go about getting a child to go to bed. But for, like I said, for me, it was just an absolute war, and if I could help any parent out, it would be with that part. The rest of it, to me, was fairly easy because there was issues at the time with the kids. They were really grouchy in the mornings. They couldn't get ready on time. We were always late. They were doing bad in school with bad grades, and it all connected back to that getting them to get, you know, on a schedule and in bed on time. So I wanted to put that in the book. So the book was aimed at toddlers, really, like about 3 to 4, maybe up to 6, 7 years old. And then they could, a mom and dad with nothing more than their iPhone or iPad, you know, if they've got the e-book, can just go into the room, sit down, read a nice little rhyming story. They can turn the music on if they want to rhyme to different songs, kind of like pick your choice of music like this. And if the kids just aren't ready to go to bed, not the end of the world. There's games, there's puzzles and things like that that are built into the book that you access online. So again, click a button, even a child could do it, and it will basically load that for you without you having to download or configure anything. And just let's play a little game, let's do a little crossword of something or a little puzzle, and then we'll go back and read the book and you'll go to sleep is the idea.
Just right now on your mobile device, Bear, B-E-A-R, and A-N-D, B-B-E-E dot buzz, B-U-Z-Z. Just go ahead and put it in there and hit send to your daughter, your son, and you'll want to get your copies anyway for home, grandma and grandpa. I think that opportunities like this are rare because the options are so vast. Often we get lost in the clutter and don't know what direction to go. If you trust Sean Seery, S-E-R-E-I, did I spell that right?
You did very okay. Well, and you pronounced it perfectly. Thank you.
Then you'll see a fabulous website, kingdomofmeridium.com, and then a whole download of options to select from. You'll be there for a while. I recommend not selecting the book trailer while you're listening to the show. That can be a little rough, okay?
But yeah, the music kind of booms in there. It's meant to sort of catch you right away.
But I love the imagery there, and you'll have to tell us all about the Kingdom of Meridium. But I wanted to spend some time on Bear and Bee. In that series, how many do you expect?
Well, you know, I don't know if I've set a number yet. It's meant to take, as far as the themes behind the books, there's sort of an agenda there, but not a bad one. It's probably going to be, I would think, up to maybe 10 volumes because they're short. They're not very long. It just takes a while to get them, you know, produced, illustrated, and then published out to all the masses.
Yes. Are they edible?
Edible, like, and you can eat them.
Well, you know, kids. Yeah. You know, everything goes right to the mouth.
Right. Well, the print versions, I'm not sure what they're going to put them on. I'm hoping some form of rugged cardboard or whatever it is that
sure,
they call that.
That's right.
Board, I think it is. We'll see what they do with it.
Yeah.
But, the idea there, of course, would be to just have as many as possible. As long as people are enjoying them, I'll keep writing them because they don't take me long to write. I wrote the first book in about 15 minutes. It was just a little poem, you know, real quick about this bear.
Yes, yes. Now, what about graphics?
The graphics, I have fantastic graphics. I didn't do them myself. A lot of the things I do like to try and do them on my own, but the graphics were designed by a fantastic artist in Indonesia. Wonderful guy. He did everything for me, and I would just like write him notes. Can you give me a scene where the bear is doing this or the bee's doing that? And he would come back with these gorgeous pictures. And I was just like, oh, my God, I just drop it right in and it's ready. So he was fantastic, and he'll be my artist forever as far as I'm concerned. He was great.
It takes a team often in an artistic endeavor, right? Either family or friends or others who have skills outside of your own to complement and make a good work. Did you reach out to any editors or proofreaders?
Yes, I did. Well, it was a two-part effort. One, of course, was the translations because it's in 5 languages, and I don't have that kind of expertise, especially with the more difficult ones like Chinese. And I said, well, I'm sure I can find somebody. So I had to reach out to different translators, a total of 4. I didn't trust my own, you know, my ability to flirt in Spanish or French is one thing, but, you know, when you're actually translating a book, you don't want to get that wrong. So I had experts do all that and get the translations done. And then in terms of sort of the end user, I had a total of three different folks, one with an expertise in daycare, one a mom of like seven kids. I mean, she knows everything about kids, obviously. And another was a lady who's, she's a friend of mine that I met through the film festivals. She's an advocate on autism. And she has two autistic daughters, and she herself has Asperger's, but she speaks, she's spoken to the UN, she's spoken to Parliament. I mean, she's it, you know, and all from her own passion for educating people about, you know, how autism actually works, and especially Asperger's, and how to detect it in girls versus boys. But she also looked at it, and they checked the book, and I said, look, here it is, without me giving you any prompting, just could you share it with your kids and tell me what's the effect, what do they like, what do they not like, did you lose them? And they gave me great feedback to help me really perfect the final package, which is out right now.
You know, it really does take that polish. You know, you want the work to last for decades, and you also want readers to come back, you know, and that's what you've done here. Handsomely produced, beautiful website, easy to maneuver. You have a blog, it's interactive, media reviews, all kinds of, easy to shop. I mean, it's right there. Oh, what's Natasha's Natural Remedies?
Oh, Natasha's, all right. Well, that's on the other side. Of course, that's on The Beekeeper's Daughter. And what we did there, I have an expert in merchandising and things like that, and she helped me a lot with that. But what we did was, I wanted to make a way with The Beekeeper's Daughter, because it's a long book. It's 118,000 words, and it's you know, it's juicy as far as romance novels go. Of course, that's my own definition, but it has gotten great reviews. And so I said, you know, these characters in the book, they're so realistic, and they're based on little bits and pieces of everyone that I knew from, like, the Russian community when I was learning Russian. And so I created these characters and these little events and cities and so forth. I said, wouldn't it be great if the main character, whose name is Masha or Maria, that's the formal name, and Masha in Russian is like the short version, wouldn't it be great if Masha were able to have souvenirs from the book, and then, of course, that could be merchandise for the book. So rather than have merchandise that says, hey, buy my book, here's a copy of the cover, I wanted to go completely opposite of that and come up with merchandise right out of the story, which is based in 1290 AD, medieval Russia. And so here you've got Natasha's Remedies, which is a character in the book, Natasha, who was a doctor. Of course, she would have been considered a witch back in that time because of her knowledge of medicine and so forth. So she was this person they went to when someone was injured, and that was her role in the story. And there's a Natasha, there's a Svetlana, there's all these Russian names that come into play in all of the merchandise, and most of it's T-shirts. But for Natasha's, we actually made the tea that is referenced in the story.
The Beekeeper's Daughter, why did you set the book in that period of time?
I wanted to go back far enough to where there was some sort of turmoil that would drive a story. And I, of course, I could have gone anywhere, but I had a knowledge of Russian and Russian people, and I wanted to put that to use. And there was this concept in my head that just sort of, I mean, literally, I started in England, and I had to backpedal to make the first story because I had all of these time holes, you know, in my timeline. So it started actually in England, and there was a Russian girl getting off a boat, and she was being enslaved. Okay, well, how did she get there? Why is she Russian? What's the story with her? So I realized, well, let me write a few chapters to kind of introduce her before I get into the main story in England, which is where the Kingdom of Meridian is. And then I realized this is going to take five books, and the first book is going to be her story and how she got here. So backpedaled a bit, restarted writing. And then, of course, based on the medieval period in England, I had to synchronize that with Russia and then do some history research and so forth to line everything up. So that's how I got there, to medieval Russia. And then from there, of course, just used a lot of the folklore and the knowledge that's very common in Russia about how people lived back then during that time.
Yes, it's a rich period of time in church history as well.
Absolutely.
With the Russian Orthodox Church and the power that they had on lands and the czars who ruled those lands.
Yes, and that's very prevalent in the story, actually, even the use of Latin and so forth, which is that's referenced even in the first chapter. But there's quite a bit of things that were going on in Russia and during that period where they had been invaded by what's called the Tatars, which were an outstretch of the Mongol horde. And they were under this sort of attack, so it would be easy to set a story where someone is sort of running from the invasion and that kind of thing, and that's how her story really gets going, and puts her on a ship going up the Volga River towards her place of safety that she's trying to get to.
Fascinating. And, you know, in that period of time, the role of a beekeeper was significant to any community because of the pollinization that would take place for the fruit trees and vegetables and other things, right? So,
oh, yes. Your orchards depended on the bees, and then everyone depended on the bee products, which was, of course, mead for drinking. So before beer, there was mead, and that's how far back it goes. They had figured out how to make an alcoholic beverage out of what the bees produced. Of course, the honey, the candles, you think about it, the beekeeper was probably one of the more wealthy people in the town, because what he was able to make from bees, everybody wanted. Everyone had a use for, from candles to of course, bee honey and everything else that goes with it.
And so the family of a beekeeper would be considered to be quite special or held in high regard within a community.
Right, and because the story begins with sort of like, it starts in the city of Rostov, which is Rostov-on-Don now in Russia, and the city's just been invaded, you know, they've taken over and so forth, so a lot of the established ecosystem that you would expect, you know, where people are well off or not so well off, has all been shaken up, and everybody's just trying to survive or get out of town, really. Because of this army that's invaded their town and taken over the church and made it the headquarters and all this. So that's all in the first chapter. It's already happening. Things are falling apart. And then, of course, some terrible events occur that cause Masha to have to run for her life.
Fascinating. It allows you, in that period of time, to really build a very large vision, a big story. And so you have the beekeeper's daughter, the king's bodyguard, fall of Meridian, the lost kingdom, and the return to Meridian. Right. Those are the books that will be released.
That's correct. Those are the last. The beekeeper's daughter, of course, is the first of five, and the entire series will pretty much be her entire lifetime from beginning to end is how it will work.
What a fascinating journey and world that you're living in. How do you keep it all straight?
I'm sorry, can you say that again? I had someone knock on my door.
Yeah, it must be, you're living in a world you've created, grounded in a certain amount of history.
Oh yes, absolutely. In fact, it's odd because, you know, when you're the one writing it, you're sort of the creator. But what I found interesting was, I would stop writing for maybe a half hour, get something to eat, and in my mind, I'm still there. You know, I'm still on a ship.
That's
or
right.
I'm out in the field or something like that.
Yes, and it really does take over. And, you know, every year you're with it, you become a part of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I had one of the best compliments I had was one of my readers who was sort of a beta tester. She came and she said, "I want to be this girl." She said, "I'm so fascinated with this character. I hate that you left me hanging with the end of the first book. So a little bit of a warning, you know, it's a series, so not everything is answered in the first. But it was," she said, I want to be this girl on that ship and to live that life and experience it the way I read it. I could hear the boards creaking on the ship, and I was like, oh God, you totally got it. You know, I'm glad it worked. So that was a very, very nice compliment, because you wonder, again, are they going to get it? You know, did I write it in a way that kind of connects with the brain and makes you feel like you're actually in the story?
You're enjoying the process.
Oh, yes. This is, it's a bit of a therapy, I think, but it's great. It's been fantastic.
Yeah, you know, it's in your blood. Now, of course, getting the first couple published and out there and building the website, there's a lot of hard work. It's an entrepreneurial enterprise.
Oh, I couldn't agree more, yeah. And my publisher, which is Auris Publishing, they've been really helpful, and they understood me. They're kind of a boutique publisher. They don't do a lot of books. And they just said, listen, if you want to do a lot of this yourself, which I did, I just wanted that creative control. It's, you know, we can arrange it that way. So, you know, they're only taking a minimal amount, you know, in terms of what they get, and the rest is all on me, which is fine for them and it's fine for me. So that it's good to find a publisher you can work with. Well, yes, it is a tremendous learning curve. All these different things you want to do on a website, or, you know, if you want to have games for kids on one, or you want to do something crazy with videos on the other, well, you got to go learn how. But I think it makes it, it kind of makes you a better writer when you, you sort of have to go figure out how these things work. Maybe somewhat, not so much for the first book, but the second book, third book, you'll know what you're doing when you get into it.
I love the Kindle, the iBooks, Kobo. Those are really great ways to get introduced to an author. And obviously, once you have delved a little more deeply, you'll want the print copy.
Right, and it is available in print. It's on demand. I didn't want to be that author with, you know, stacks of books that no one wants in his house. So I said, I'll make print books, but they've got to be on demand. I don't want to do it any other way. And they sell occasionally, but most people buy the e-book. And because I wanted it to be in this story that anyone could get to anywhere in the world, I even worked with it were Russian publishers who do e-books in Russia. And that was probably the hardest market to get into. It took a lot of research to find the right person who could, you know, kind of introduce me to the right person to get them introduced into what's called, it's really the Russian Amazon. It's called Litrez and Ozone. Those are their two big sites for books. And they have, of course, tons of books there. And Russians are just incredibly consummate readers. They read all the time, probably 10 times more than Americans. So I wanted to be in that market, especially with a story that began in Russia. And now it's being translated into Russian. So I'm looking forward to seeing how well it does once it's in the home language and not an English version that may or may not appeal to people over there.
Now, at the pub, are you getting a lot of comments about Volga River Shipping Company t-shirt?
Well, right now, I've not seen too many. I think my favorite t-shirt, of course, I've got about six or seven different types, but my favorite one is Oksana's Tavern. It looks like a biker's shirt. You know, it's black and white and kind of cool, and I was watching probably way too much Sons of Anarchy at the time when I made it, but it's got that kind of a look to it, you know, a little bit rough. And Oksana's Tavern in the story is exactly that. It's a tavern where you go and you can spend the night for the right amount of money, that kind of a place back in medieval time. So, that's probably my favorite shirt. The Volga River, though, on Instagram is probably my number one. Everybody clicks likes on that, and, you know, it gets a lot of popular response when I put pictures of it up on a model.
It's all natural, 100% cotton. We love that, and the color is great. It's unique. You know, it's not something that you find at Walmart.
Absolutely. It's unique and made right here in the United States, and they ship it to your door if you order it there. And it's available on Amazon as well, on their marketing side, or merch, I think they call it. But making T-shirts was not the part of the plan, but then it just seemed to make sense to add it. And then again, another little silo of information you've got to go figure out and then come back with it, you know, to add it. But all fun. You know, it was all good.
Well, it's a way to support the fan club, you know. Rock and roll bands have been doing it forever.
Absolutely.
You go to
absolutely.
A concert, what do? You leave with a T-shirt. Yeah. Come on.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
And our writers are rock stars for us when they pen the way that our guest this hour on Authors First does. And audience, you're going to love the material, the imagery, the graphics, everything that you've pulled together. So professional and complimentary. Thank you, Sean Seary, for joining Authors First and telling us about this journey of yours and how it has materialized into this wonderful Kingdom of Meridian. KingdomofMeridian.com, the website. Audience, be sure to share our content with everyone on social media network sites, because quality authors deserve to be known about. And you've certainly found one here in our guest, Sean Seary. Putting together a package like this, it takes a lot of effort, you know. You really have to think through all of the ramifications of what you're doing so that it's not a distraction from your core business of writing medieval romance sagas. And having time to do that and live in that world can be a challenge, right?
Oh, absolutely, and I think that's my number one difficulty, really. It's not ideas. Those come nonstop. I think it's just finding the time to write, because you've got you know, you're going in all directions, and a lot of us artists also have you know, daytime jobs we've got to take care of. So you, yeah, it's just there's a limited amount of time to sit and write, and I kind of need absolute quiet, you know, when I'm doing it, because I'm there, I'm in that world, and my hands are just taking dictation about what I see, and that's kind of how it works for me. But the time for that is tough, and especially when you're trying to get a video produced or make a T-shirt or whatever it is that you're up to today to try and promote your book. Yeah,
it does. And as you said, you have to be in the zone. They the characters, the plot, everything takes over, and now you just are the mechanism pounding it out.
Oh, absolutely. And I've got this, you know, you mentioned that, the process is, I've got this spreadsheet, you know, for the five books, and it's just riff with notes of, oh, wait, then this could, no, that has to happen first, and then this. And so you're sitting down and you're trying to write, oh, this is five books here, how are you going to line this up and make up the twist that will work later? And so that it's actually kind of fun, but I've never had to do that before, because everything was start and finish in one little piece, you know, never a five series type of project.
Are you surprised? Do you discover that characters begin talking back?
Well, yes. I mean, it'll be, I would say from my personal experience, there was one character, I was going to have a priest in one scene where they're, you know, two girls go to a church and they're looking for someone, and they figure someone in church will know where they are, and they're going to ask a priest. He's going to give them an answer, and off they go. And I end up thinking, like, what if the priest was an ex-soldier who became a priest, and he's moot because he can't speak, he had his tongue cut out, and he's actually really cool, and he has to talk with his hands. So how do you write that? Yeah, and that's, his name's Boris. He's actually a great character in the book. But Boris is this mute priest, you know, who has to speak with his hands. And when you're writing this, you've got no visuals, right? So you have to describe what he's describing with his hands, and then the other person reacts to it. And that was a lot of fun, but it's just like that, right? It was supposed to be a quick scene, and then two chapters later, you're still describing Boris.
Well, and there's a place for everyone, right? Why is he mute? How did he become a priest, you see? Was he left on a doorstep? You know, there's so...
Yeah, and you get these flashbacks later on. You're like, oh, I know what I'll do. I'll make this mean something. And then
you know, and suddenly a whole person is fleshed out right in your mind that becomes either a dominant or less so dominant character in the series. Either they're so strong and compelling, they keep coming back over and over, right, in every book, or they fade into insignificance and the character moves on without that influence.
Right. Yeah, and that's exactly that. Boris just was one of those unplanned characters that emerged, and of many, and you're just like, oh, I could do this with him, and he'll save the day, you know. Yeah.
So there's surprises along the way, and I imagine a number of challenges also, setbacks. You think you're headed in a direction, and then you turn around and have to come back to it. But tell us about travel in the series.
In terms of the characters in the book, the whole story sort of unfolds along the Volga River. So you've got all these cities that are real cities, actually exist even today, most of them, that are sort of setting the pace. So, you know, sort of like the story begins with coming into port, and then that's the chapter, and then they're off the port, and so that it takes you along. And from my personal experience in traveling in Russia, I've been to Russia multiple times and you know, loved it. It made a big impact on me for me to use it in a story. But being able to sort of take those memories and turn them into something that a person who will never see that country could imagine, I think that was a real gift, because for me it was just a wonderful place to go and visit. Nothing like what I thought it would be at all. It was a complete surprise, and now I understand why people tour there, because there's such a different kind of energy in Eastern Europe than anywhere else I've ever been.
Yeah, well, the commerce, not only is traveling the river into different ethnicities, it also embraces coming and going of culture more broadly.
Right. Everyone's on their way to something else. No one's actually local except for a handful, and you've got these, you know, the smell of the sea, and you know, the barrels being rolled off the ship as you get down into the harbor, and all this, and you can, you know, you hear the seagulls pretty soon, and all that. It all connects, and you feel yourself, you know, part of this this scenery. And then, of course, the characters on some kind of mission, something that they need to do in that particular town.
Well, these are medieval times, the 12th century, so we're not dealing with ships of modern construction here.
Right, right. Yeah.
These are powered by human beings.
Right, a little bit of sailing and mostly oars, and they had men, of course, for that. And I actually toured some traditionally built ships that were made in Spain, and I got to learn a lot about what went into building those ships. And what I didn't realize was that those ships that you see from, you know, any kind of ancient painting or something didn't last very long at all, because all of the ships had worms in the wood that they couldn't get out because they were like buried down inside the wood. So a ship would only last a very short while before it just kind of was eaten up and they would sink. So this was all being explained to me by a fellow who worked on this sort of medieval ship that they had recreated. And it was just a constant war against the worms and the pitch and everything else to try to get them out. And they almost had a carpenter on board, you know, nonstop whenever they were at sea. And I thought, wow, you know, I never thought about that. You know, just little things like that that you pick up and you're like, oh, I got to put that in a story, you know, and all that. So, yeah, medieval ships were very different than our modern, you know, type of modern appliances that we have today. And the mission, of course, was much simpler when you got off of a boat. You were really looking for food or a place to stay the night. That was about it. You know, that's all there was to do. A little bit of trading, maybe.
What a fun time you're having with the Kingdom of Meridian. Congratulations on this fabulous series and website. Thank you, Sean, for contributing to the arts and joining us at Artists First Radio.
Thank you, Tony. It's been a pleasure, and I really, really appreciate all that y'all are doing there at Artists First. I really do appreciate that, and it's just been wonderful talking with you and sharing some about the book. And thank you, everyone, for listening, and hope you'll come and see us there at either BaronB.buzz or KingdomOfMeridian.com.
Yes, and you'll have to come back, right?
I mean, absolutely. I'd love to. I've got another book coming. The sequel is coming out very soon, so I'll be glad to come back and talk more about that.
Sure. When do you expect that, Sean?
Oh, God, I'm terrible with the dates. I always say it's going to be soon, and then it takes...
Sometime in 2017?
Oh, absolutely, this year, without a doubt. I'll probably have another BaronB book out this year as well. It's kind of like my break from writing one or the other. I just kind of go to the other book and write on that one for a while. So, yeah, both of those will have a sequel this year.
Thank you, Sean. Thank you very much, audience, for joining us. Be sure to follow the link provided at artistfirst.com to learn more about our fabulous author this hour. Thank you, Sean. See you next time, okay?
Thank you, Tony.